Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 29th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week shows Elon Musk. They've got him dressed up looking a little bit like a cat. He's got cat ears, and you can see a cat tail coming out behind him. There are a lot of the little Twitter bird, blue Twitter bird symbols around. He's reaching, trying to grab one, and it looks like he's actually got one of them in his mouth. The headline is Swallowing Twitter. If Elon Musk's hostile takeover succeeds, what will it mean for public discourse? And we'll get that as our second main story, but we will start with the latest from Ukraine. The battle for Donbas begins. What happened? Russia launched a new offensive aimed at capturing the eastern Donbas region of Ukraine this week, stepping up its bombardment of strategic areas in preparation for a major assault. The next phase of this special operation begins now, said Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, calling its goal the complete liberation of the eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Ukrainian forces succeeded in driving back numerous attempted Russian advances, according to the UK Ministry of Defense, and U.S. officials and Russia had made no territorial gains, said Russia had made no territorial gains. The Pentagon called the Russian operation a prelude to a larger offensive for which troops and artillery are still being moved into place. The Russians are thought to have some 75,000 soldiers surrounding the Donbas, including up to 20,000 foreign mercenaries. The offensive follows a stunning symbolic and strategic success by Ukrainian forces, the sinking of the Russian battleship Moskva in the Black Sea last week. The Ukrainian officials said missile strikes downed the flagship of Russia's Black Sea fleet, a claim verified by Western intelligence. Bristling with missiles, the Moskva, which means Moscow, was considered essential to a possible amphibious assault on Ukraine's coastal cities, including Odessa. But Russian forces were close to seizing the southeastern port city of Mariupol after weeks of bombardment that had killed thousands of civilians and left the city in ruins. Several hundred Ukrainian troops, along with an estimated 1,000 civilians, were holed up in a sprawling Soviet-era steel plant, refusing a Russian ultimatum to surrender. The Ukrainians warned that their supplies were nearly tapped out, and in a video posted on social media, a commander said the troops were facing our last days, if not hours. President Biden was expected to announce a new military aid package comparable to the $800 million in tanks, helicopters, long-range artillery, and other heavy weaponry released last week. Russia warned that increased U.S. aid was adding fuel to the conflict and could lead to unpredictable consequences. Still, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pleaded with Western leaders for more. Without a major influx of heavy weaponry, he said, this war will become an endless bloodbath, spreading misery, suffering, and destruction. What the editorial said. The war is now at a pivotal juncture, said the New York Daily News, and Western leaders must amp up support for the brave Ukrainians with robust weapons and supply shipments. Putin has failed miserably at every turn, including in his goal of fracturing NATO, and his army's ongoing war crimes make clear that he cannot be allowed to succeed. His dark warnings of retaliation should only stiffen our spines. U.S. military aid to Ukraine has been utterly inadequate, said the Washington Examiner. With the battle shifting to open terrain in the east, Ukraine desperately needs more tanks and missiles, rocket systems to hit Russian offensive lines with long-range fire, and mobile air defense systems to blunt Russia's air advantage. But the Biden administration is still guided by excessive fear of provoking Russian escalation. What the columnist said. The race is on, said Stephen Erlanger in the New York Times. As the Eastern Offensive begins, NATO countries are scrambling to supply Ukraine with bigger and more advanced weapons, including howitzers, armed drones, and armored trucks. But as Moscow issues threats of consequences, the redoubled support risks antagonizing Russia so much that it ignites a wider international conflict. Putin is bluffing, said former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul in the Washington Post, and the West should not be cowed by his empty threats. Even a cornered Putin wouldn't use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Violating the nuclear taboo would alienate many countries currently sitting on the sidelines, including China, and undermine domestic support for the war. Nor would Putin dare to attack NATO arms convoys and pit his battered, dysfunctional army against the largest military alliance in the world. The war is about to change dramatically, said Harry Kazianis in the New York Post, and that spells trouble for Kyiv's freedom fighters. Nimble Ukrainian forces were able to repel Russian invaders in the urban and forested north using guerrilla strikes that wiped out lumbering tank convoys. But the wide-open Donbas provides a major advantage to the heavily armed Russians, who will use massive tank columns and lots of bombers in the sky to take large chunks of flat, rolling country. Russia's advantages are undeniable, said Rachel Treisman in NPR.org. But whether it has the combat power and competence to leverage them is a big question. Russian units are demoralized and have been weakened by extensive casualties, poorly trained conscripts, and damaged equipment. Ukrainian forces are battling for their homeland, and retired U.S. Army officer John Spencer points out they have a key weapon that could prove decisive, the will to fight. Musk makes a bid for Twitter. What happened? Twitter's board of directors scrambled this week to fend off a hostile takeover threat by Tesla CEO and prolific tweeter Elon Musk, who claims the social media company turns off users by stifling free expression. Musk has been buying shares of Twitter for months and now owns over 9%. While he declined a seat on its board, he said last week he wants to take the company private and announced an offer of $43 billion. The next day, the board adopted a poison pill measure, saying it would sell discounted shares if any investor's stake exceeded 15%. But analysts doubted that many sellers would accept Musk's purportedly final offer of $54.20 a share, more than the $45 the stock had been recently valued at, but less than last year's high of $72. Calling Twitter a de facto public town square, Musk said he wanted to transform it into a platform for free speech by loosening content moderation and making its algorithm more transparent and customizable. Some Republicans cheered the prospect. Twitter censors are freaking out, Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn tweeted, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis threatened to sue board members for breaching their fiduciary duty. But the deal is far from certain. To finance the purchase, Musk would likely have to take out a loan against his Tesla shares, and the banks or Tesla's board could block such a loan. Other potential buyers, though, have already signaled interest, including private equity firm Thoma Bravo. What the editorial said. This could be entertaining, said the Wall Street Journal. We don't quite buy Musk's economic rationale, but he appears serious about free speech. While social media companies are not bound by the First Amendment's protection against censorship, Twitter's moderators have far too much power to shape discourse, such as by blocking legitimate conservative-leaning stories like the tale of Hunter Biden's wayward laptop as misinformation. They even silenced former President Donald Trump, kicking him off the platform in 2021. Maybe Musk can find a fairer way. Twitter adopted its strict rules for good reason, said the Washington Post. For years, bad actors have used the site to spread lies, dox and harass people, and endanger public health. Moderators sometimes make mistakes, but their work requires the kind of sober, mature mindset Musk lacks. Note that his $54.20 per share price contains an apparent reference to marijuana, as did his juvenile 2018 claim of having the funds needed to take Tesla private at $420 a share. Let's hope his latest gambit doesn't succeed. What the columnist said. Twitter should be beneath Musk, said Rich Lowry in National Review. He is the rare Silicon Valley titan who creates not software or social media, but revolutionary physical products, such as electric vehicles and rockets. But liberal hysteria over his takeover threat, one Axios journalist compared him to a movie supervillain, shows why he wants to intervene. While Twitter has just 200 million regular users, dwarfed by the billions who post on Facebook and TikTok, it's a gathering place for elites, and its boundaries for acceptable speech have been sliding ever leftward. Musk's bid threatens the way Twitter imposes progressive rules on the public debate. Don't take the claims of this self-professed free speech absolutist at face value, said Scott Nover in Quartz. The man is known for firing Tesla employees who disagree with him. It's likely that Musk simply wants to exert control over a site that lets him sound off to more than 82 million followers while trolling the Securities and Exchange Commission. That agency fined Musk $20 million for his 2018 Tesla stock tweets, and he clearly retains a deep grudge against the regulators he refers to as those bastards. The Twitter standoff could just be a proxy battle. Still, Musk is onto something, said Gilad Edelman in Wired. Twitter has become the way to be heard by people with power and is therefore an oddly crucial tool for democratic participation. That's extremely unhealthy, especially since the site's secret algorithm makes the most outrageous viewpoints seem more prevalent than they are, a misconception that seeps into journalism and politics. If Musk's maneuver forces us to see how over-reliance on Twitter has hurt public discourse, he really will have struck a blow for free expression, just not the way he imagined. Our controversy of the week is America's gerontocracy. Are our leaders too old? America has a gerontocracy problem, said David Graham in The Atlantic. Washington's halls of powers are filled with people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, a problem that was thrown into sharp relief last week when the San Francisco Chronicle published a remarkable story claiming that 88-year-old Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California, has become mentally unfit to serve. In the piece, four senators and three former staffers recount moments over the past 2 years when Feinstein has failed to fully recognize longtime colleagues and seemed confused during discussions of policy issues. Feinstein has denied she's in mental decline, but she is the tip of the iceberg, said Peter Sutterman in Reason.com. This is the oldest Senate in American history, with an average age of 64. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is 80. Senator Chuck Grassley, 88. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, 82. In an era in which technology regulation and climate change have taken center stage, We're being governed by octogenarians who haven't had a new idea in decades, raising serious questions about the ability of our nation's governing class to perform their jobs. The presidency is no exception, said Rod Dreher, an American conservative. Our current commander-in-chief is 79. If he runs for a second term and wins, President Biden will be 82 on Inauguration Day and 86 at the end of his second term. His most likely 2024 opponent, Donald Trump, will be 78 if he's inaugurated a second time. At that age, there's a much greater risk of senility and physical decline, as Biden is already demonstrating. While Biden has always had a tendency for gaffes, his impulsive senior moments during the Ukraine crisis, calling for regime change in Russia and labeling Russian atrocities a genocide, have crossed over from embarrassing to downright dangerous. Octogenarians have long had an iron grip on Washington, D.C., said Meghan McCain in the Daily Mail. I vividly recall having lunch with my dad, Senator John McCain, in the Senate dining room and seeing Senator Strom Thurmond, then in his 90s, wheeled to his table, and a caregiver proceeded to put his napkin on him and help feed him. Thurmond died 5 months after leaving office when he was 100 years old. Senator Robert Byrd, the Democrat from West Virginia, served until age 92. By the end, he was voting with hand signals. In the private sector, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, a board of directors would find a way to shunt a senile CEO aside. But in the Senate, there is no age cap. That leaves it up to the voters to oust politicians who have passed their prime. But staffs often cover up the fact that elected officials are no longer functioning, and most people in power are simply unwilling to recognize when it's time to step down. The solution is clear. Age limits on our legislators, said Maureen Callahan in the New York Post. Commercial airline pilots have a mandatory retirement age, 65, and so do air traffic controllers, 56. A recent YouGov poll found that a clear majority of Americans want an age limit of 70 for elected officials. If that limit were brought in now, it would force 71% of current senators to retire. Who really thinks that a cohort of 70 and 80-somethings should be charting America's future? Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for insecure MAGA men. After Fox's Tucker Carlson began promoting a documentary called The End of Men, with tips on how to raise testosterone levels, including testicle tanning, which involves exposing male privates to red LED light. It was good week for Toby Keith, a 21-year-old Chihuahua in Florida, just recognized as the oldest dog alive by Guinness World Records. People can't believe how good he looks for his age, said the owner. It was a good week for Grand Theft Gouda, after thieves broke into a dairy farm in the Netherlands and stole 3,500 pounds of the classic Dutch cheese worth over $22,000. Investigators are trying to figure out how the thieves managed to escape with 161 massive wheels of cheese. It was a bad week for historical examples, after Tennessee Republican State Senator Frank Nicely cited Adolf Hitler as proof that homelessness isn't a dead end, claiming the genocidal leader lived on the streets but went on to lead a life that got him in the history books. It was a bad week for screen time after zookeepers said Amare, a 415-pound gorilla at Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo, is so addicted to the smartphone photos and videos park visitors have been showing him through a glass partition that he's now ignoring other gorillas. Finally, it was a bad week for disgraced newsmen after former Fox host Bill O'Reilly was videoed threatening a JetBlue worker when his flight from New York City to Turks and Caicos was delayed 3 hours. "You effing scumbag," said O'Reilly, 72. "You're going to lose your job." And a short in other news piece. Biden's made $610,000 last year, return show. Joe and Jill Biden reported $610,702 in earnings last year and paid $150,439 in federal income taxes, an effective rate of 24.6%, according to returns they released last week. President Biden made slightly less than $400,000 presidential salary because he was inaugurated on January 20th, while the First Lady made about $67,000 from teaching at Northern Virginia Community College. The Bidens reported $62,000 from book royalties. They gave $17,394 to charities, including several churches and the Beau Biden Foundation, named for their late son. Vice President Kamala Harris and her husband, lawyer Douglas Emhoff, reported paying $523,371 in federal taxes on $1,655,563 in income, while giving $22,100 to charity. Our briefing this week is titled, Why Ventilation Matters. After extensive studies of how COVID spreads, scientists and policymakers are focusing on indoor air quality. What do we know? One of the most powerful tools for limiting the spread of COVID-19 has been right in front of our noses, purifying the air we breathe. After extensive studies of outbreaks, super spreader events, and aerosol dynamics, epidemiologists who specialize in respiratory disease have warned that maintaining 6 feet of distance from others isn't sufficient to avoid indoor infection. It took the World Health Organization more than a year to acknowledge that COVID doesn't just travel via large respiratory droplets that fall to the ground quickly, but also spreads in tiny, aerosolized particles that can linger in the air like a fine mist for hours. As mask mandates are lifted, this underscores how crucial it is to keep air flowing in crowded indoor places by equipping buildings with ventilation systems that pump virus-laden air outside and with filtration devices that trap viral particles. Think of aerosolized virus as cigarette smoke, said Joseph Allen, director of Harvard's Healthy Buildings Program. If I'm smoking in the corner of a classroom and you have low ventilation filtration, that room is going to fill up with smoke, Allen said. But outdoors, he said, you could be a couple of feet from me, depending on which way the wind was blowing. You may not even know I'm smoking. How does the coronavirus travel? Every time we exhale, air rushes out of our lungs and through our nose and mouth in a warm cloud of respiratory fluid. Droplets that emerge when we yell or cough can be as wide as a strand of human hair, but the coronavirus travels mainly through the millions of aerosols, droplets just a few thousandths of a millimeter wide, released with each breath. In a crowded, poorly ventilated room, up to 4% of each inhalation is someone else's breath. University of Oregon researchers found there was not much difference between the number of aerosol particles shared between people standing 4 feet versus 11 feet apart. Humidity helps, however. Studies indicate that in dry places, like many offices and restaurants, respiratory droplets travel farther and longer. Where do infections occur? Mostly indoors. There have been very few reports of outdoor transmission, even when tens of thousands of people converge for concerts or sporting events. because there's unlimited ventilation outside. One of the first COVID super spreader events at a March 2020 choir rehearsal in Washington State highlighted the limitations of indoor social distancing. Despite taking steps to spread out singers in the church, 52 out of 61 participants tested positive for COVID within a few weeks, and two choir members died. Scientists point out that the more people there are in an indoor space, the greater the risk one of them is infectious and emitting invisible clouds of virus. That explains why crowded restaurants, gyms, and conference rooms with poor circulation have produced many outbreaks. How can ventilation help? It brings in fresh air and pumps out air that people have exhaled, thus diluting the concentration of possible coronavirus particles. It also reduces the risk of catching the flu and cold viruses, which also spread through the air. A study of more than 10,000 classrooms in Italy found that good ventilation systems reduced COVID transmission by 82.5%. Airplanes are another good example of ventilation in action. Sitting in an aircraft cabin is one of the safest ways to travel, since half of the air passengers breathe comes from outside the plane, and the other half is recirculated through high-efficiency particulate air, HEPA or HEPA filters, that provide a minimum capture efficiency of 99.97%, better than in most buildings. You can, however, be infected on a plane if you're sitting next to an infected person. What steps should be taken? Just opening windows improves ventilation, especially when they're at opposite ends of a room. Portable HEPA filters are effective, and UV light has also proven to be effective when used to treat air passing through a building's heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. Experts are also publicizing the folly of using plexiglass dividers to shield people from one another's breath. Studies show that while these barriers might block a spray of droplets, like sneeze guards at salad bars, they also impede air circulation and may serve to raise the risk of infection. Is good ventilation commonplace? No, which is why the White House recently released an action plan for improving indoor air quality to fight the spread of COVID. For decades, engineers have prioritized making buildings more energy efficient, favoring recirculation over ventilation. Pumped in outdoor air needs to be cooled or heated, and in a typical commercial building, HVAC accounts for up to 40% of total energy expended. That percentage rises when thick MERV 13 filters are installed to capture aerosols. Overhauling HVAC systems is expensive, so there will be resistance, said Lindsay Marr, an engineering professor at Virginia Tech. To put some teeth into this, she said, there will need to be standards and regulations, and those will take years. Got a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. Democrats facing a blowout. Democrats are facing a Biden bloodbath in November, said Charles Blow. Just 7 months from a pivotal midterm election, President Biden's popularity has plunged to the lowest of his presidency, with one poll last week putting him at only 33% approval. His successful nomination of the Supreme Court's first black woman did not give him a boost, and his once positive numbers among Hispanics, a fast-growing voting bloc, have plunged to 26%. Democratic pollsters blame poor messaging about Biden's accomplishments, but I think the problem is more on ground level, a gut level. With inflation and crime rising and the culture war raging, most Americans feel stuck and angry, and they blame the president. Biden is a decent man, but he's not very visible or charismatic, and he hasn't made an emotional connection with voters. and the Republican strategy of inflaming parental anxieties about racial and LGBTQ issues is working. Young progressives and blacks are frustrated that Biden has made no progress on voting rights legislation or police reform. Unless Biden can turn things around over the next 6 months, Democrats may see their control of the House and Senate swept away in a Republican landslide. Numb to 1 million deaths. At the start of the pandemic in March 2020, Dr. Anthony Fauci warned that the U.S. could face as many as 240,000 COVID deaths, said Nicholas Goldberg. President Trump and his allies scoffed, urging Americans to get back to normal after just a few weeks. We all know how that worked out. We're now closing in on 1 million deaths, and the U.S. death rate per 100,000 population is far higher than that of all other wealthy countries. Yes, hospitalizations and deaths have finally dropped thanks to vaccination and immunity from prior infections, but scientists warn that immunity wanes against Omicron, and in the U.S. and abroad, new variants are still emerging. We may be at a pause in the pandemic rather than the end. It's hard to wrap our heads around 1 million deaths. As Joseph Stalin purportedly said, one death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. We all crave a return to normal life, but how many more deaths are acceptable? If we surrender to psychic numbing, abandon all precautions, and invite the virus to continue to spread and mutate, will we reach 2 million deaths? This isn't over yet. This column comes from Germany. Ukraine was right to snub us. Germans have no cause to feel so miffed that Ukrainians don't want to receive our leaders, said Linz Jacobson. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has hosted several Western politicians in recent weeks, including from Poland, Slovenia, and the UK. Yet when Germany tried to send President Franz Walter Steinmeier, Zelensky apparently told him to stay home. Many Germans, including Chancellor Olaf Scholz, are offended by the perceived snub. But instead of trying to explain to the Ukrainians what is best for their country, perhaps they should put themselves in Zelensky's shoes. Steinmeier, whose role is largely ceremonial, advocated closer economic ties between Russia and the West for years, and he was one of Germany's loudest cheerleaders for the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would have delivered gas from Russia to Germany, bypassing Ukraine. Since the invasion, Germany has blocked European attempts to boycott Russian energy. No wonder Zelensky doesn't want Steinmeier. Even so, he has invited Scholz, perhaps to impress upon him how much he needs German weapons. Instead of complaining about the Steinmeier slight, Scholz should be confident enough to finally make the trip himself, bringing money and guns rather than symbolic gestures. And it's time for the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Mackenzie Scott's Quiet Mission. Jeff Bezos' ex-wife has emerged as arguably the world's most influential philanthropist, said Nicholas Kulish and Rebecca Ruiz in the New York Times. But as she gives away billions, she shuns the spotlight. The billionaire philanthropist Mackenzie Scott once recounted in a television interview, a Chinese folktale sometimes known as The Lost Horse. The story is about the reversals of fortune a farmer experiences after his prize stallion runs away. It can also be read as a summary of Scott's philosophy. You never know where it's going to end up, she told television host Charlie Rose in 2013. after relating the parable to him. Good luck, bad luck. It's not the way that we really need to look at things. The hardships we experience are the things we'll look back and be the most grateful for, she said during the interview. They take us where we need to go. A few months after Scott's divorce from Amazon founder Jeff Bezos was finalized in 2019, a new shell company was quietly set up in Delaware called Lost Horse. Soon, representatives from Lost Horse were calling nonprofits around the country about multi-million-dollar donations from an anonymous giver. Her own life has taken sharp turns that have shaped her choices, including her extraordinary leap into philanthropy, which in less than 3 years has exceeded $12 billion in grants. But as Scott's fame for giving away money has grown, so too has the deluge of appeals for gifts from strangers and old friends alike. Ms. Scott, 52, has a net worth that hovers around $50 billion. She has set about dispersing her enormous fortune with unprecedented speed and directness to frontline charities and nonprofits with a stated emphasis on advancing social justice and combating inequality, all while trying to keep herself out of the spotlight. Arguably, she is the most consequential philanthropist in the world right now. Attempts to reach Scott and her husband, Dan Jewett, a chemistry teacher, for this article by phone, email, and letter, directly and through intermediaries, were met with silence. Instead, the New York Times relied on interviews with more than 24 friends, teachers, former colleagues, and acquaintances from every chapter of her life, as well as public records and the rare interviews Scott has given, generally in conjunction with the publication of one of her novels. This article is also based on previously unpublished letters between Scott and the novelist Toni Morrison, Scott's college mentor, kept in the Nobel laureate's archive at Princeton University Library. Scott's new last name is one of her own choosing. Scott was her grandfather's name. G. Scott Cumming was an executive and general counsel at El Paso Natural Gas. His wife, Dorothy, volunteered with the March of Dimes and with an organization for breast cancer survivors. Their daughter, Holiday Robin Cumming, was born on Christmas Day in 1943. She married Jason Baker Tuttle, and the couple had three children. The eldest and youngest were boys, and the middle child was a daughter, Mackenzie. Jason Baker Tuttle worked as a financial advisor while his wife stayed home with the children. The family had an expensive home in the Pacific Heights neighborhood of San Francisco and another house in the town of Ross. In the afterword of her first novel, Scott tells the story of how, when she was just 6 years old, she wrote a 142-page novel called The Bookworm, which she described as a chapter book about the adventures of a worm who loved to read. It took me almost a year of afternoons lying on our living room carpet with a stack of Oreos, a sheaf of kindergarten newsprint, and a fat pencil, she wrote, and I distinctly remember the moment when it first occurred to me that I loved writing differently than I loved riding my bike or swimming. Scott's father ran an investment advising firm called J. Baker Tuttle Corporation, which by her teenage years was paying him about $360,000, or over $900,000 in today's dollars, according to the Securities and Exchange Commission. The firm was covering his personal and business expenses, as well as four mortgages on three properties. Scott was attending the Hotchkiss Boarding School in Connecticut, while her older brother was at Georgetown University. Shortly before Scott's 17th birthday, her family's fortunes took a sudden turn. Her father's financial firm declared bankruptcy, and so did her parents. Scott graduated from Hotchkiss, where tuition rivaled the cost of college, after 3 years instead of four. With the help of a scholarship, Scott still managed to go to Princeton, albeit with a new, heavier burden. "I went off to college knowing I was going to have to work a variety of jobs to put myself through school," Scott has said, worrying about how she was going to juggle waiting tables with a full course load. Last year, Scott recalled that period and the help she received to make it through. It was the local dentist who offered me free dental work when he saw me securing a broken tooth with a denture glue in college, she said. It was the college roommate who found me crying and acted on her urge to loan me $1,000 to keep me from having to drop out sophomore year. With the sought-after prize of Morrison as her thesis advisor, Scott wrote a 168-page work of fiction called The Fathering Water, in which the father, Luther Augury, keeps hidden that he has quit his job and settled for a low-paying one. He lies about his work and showers his wife with expensive home appliances to compensate. He could not afford it, she wrote, pretending he had a job that made money and also pretending he could spend it. After graduation, Scott went back to Hotchkiss and taught a summer creative writing program. Then, like Princetonians at least as far back as F. Scott Fitzgerald, Scott moved to New York City to pursue a career as a novelist. Scott found herself juggling writing and waitressing in New York, which proved more grueling than waiting tables in Princeton, leaving her too tired to write. She was invited for an interview at a hedge fund, D.E. Shaw. The interviewer was a fellow Princeton grad, Jeffrey Preston Bezos. In a letter to Morrison, she wrote that he hired her based largely on a transcript of your phone recommendation. Scott landed in the office next to Bezos. She said that she fell for his famously booming laugh and pursued a relationship. They dated for 3 months before getting engaged and were married 3 months after that. She was 23. He was 29. It was shortly thereafter that the couple entered the rarest lore of high-tech startups. Bezos wanted to quit his job at D.E. Shaw to take a chance on selling books over the primitive dial-up version of the Internet. Given the financial instability of her teenage years, it would have been understandable if Scott had discouraged him from taking the risk. She not only supported his dream, but also worked alongside him to build the company. Scott's first book, The Testing of Luther Albright, based in part on her undergraduate thesis about Luther Augury, took her close to a decade to complete. She had advantages over other first-time authors when the novel came out in 2005. Now a Nobel laureate, Morrison connected her own powerful agent, Amanda Urban, with her mentee and gave her a coveted blurb for the cover of the book. When Scott's second novel, Traps, was published in 2013, the extremely private Scott cracked the door to her life open to the public again to promote her book. Sitting for a profile complete with photos by Vogue magazine, meeting the reporter at a Thai restaurant in Bellevue, Washington. Scott took pains on her publicity tour to demonstrate how normal she was, how she drove a regular Honda minivan when she took their four children to school. One of the main characters in Traps is a famous actress named Jessica, who worries about security and employs a bodyguard. At one point, she approaches the bodyguard's car. Jessica thinks, she will not try to influence this woman's opinion. She will not work to project what she wants others to see. Kind, down-to-earth, humble, normal. In January 2019, Scott and Bezos jointly announced on his Twitter account that they were divorcing. Scott's first big statement as a newly single woman came less than 5 months later on the website of the Giving Pledge, started by Bill Gates, Melinda French Gates, and Warren Buffett, as a place where billionaires promised to give away at least half their wealth. Scott went further, promising to keep at it until the safe is empty. Nonprofits soon began receiving calls and emails about enormous grants from an anonymous donor, often the biggest donation in the group's history, or the equivalent of a full year's budget. Some of those approaches were from staff members at the influential nonprofit consultancy Bridgespan, others from representatives at Lost Horse. The chosen charities were told they could not announce the gifts until the donor did. Scott gave big, she gave fast, she gave with few strings attached. My own reflection after recent events revealed a dividend of privilege I'd been overlooking. The attention I can call to organizations and leaders driving change, she said, in her first public catalog of her giving on the website Medium. She put herself out there, but not at the public events that, by her own admission, made her uncomfortable. Yet using the skills she'd been honing since she was eating Oreos and reading botany books, her writing. On December 15, 2020, Scott announced another even bigger round of giving, $4.2 billion to 384 organizations, including hundreds of Easter Seals, United Way, YWCA, and YMCA chapters, groups that were doing a lot of good on the front lines during the pandemic, but not the kind of innovation-focused giving that Silicon Valley set prioritizes. Some were groups that her mother might have gone to a luncheon for in Palm Beach, or her grandmother in El Paso, Texas. 3 days later, on December 18, 2020, the change of her last name to Scott was legal and official, according to court records from Bellevue. In a deeper sense, her public identity had also changed. She was no longer seen publicly as Jeff Bezos' former wife first. She was Mackenzie Scott, the novelist upending philanthropy. She had found a way to be important with no black tie fundraisers and no velvet dresses. Lost Horse has an office in a brand new eco-friendly building in Seattle. In keeping with the absolute secrecy surrounding Lost Horse's operation, there is no nameplate in the lobby, and the slim rectangular window on the Lost Horse floor is papered over. On a recent morning, no one answered the door or the phone. A man who appeared to be a security guard at an address linked to another shell company in an affluent corner of Seattle said, "They're not available at the moment." Shortly after a reporter appeared at those addresses seeking comment last month, Scott published another missive on Medium, announcing another $3.86 billion in gifts and returning to her practice of noting the total dollar value of her gifts. In it, she seemed to address the contradictory urges of preserving privacy while commanding attention for the causes she supported. Her approach to press inquiry, she wrote, involved respecting the autonomy and role of journalists by doing nothing to try to influence or control what they report. "We are all human," she wrote in the post, "and we all have enormous energy to devote to helping and protecting those we love." A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. And we're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled "Abortion: The Coming War Between the States." The Supreme Court 6 conservatives are expected in June to overturn or significantly weaken Roe versus Wade. But red states aren't waiting, said Oriana Gonzalez in Axios. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a 15-week abortion ban, making no exceptions for race or incest. GOP governors of Arizona, Kentucky, and Oklahoma recently signed similar laws, modeled after the Mississippi abortion ban before the high court. Oklahoma's law would criminalize nearly all abortions, and anyone providing one would face up to 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. At least 25 states are poised to outlaw or dramatically restrict access to abortion as soon as Roe falls, said Rebecca Traister in New York Magazine. Women in half the country will soon face a geographic nightmare. Perhaps not, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. Widespread access to the abortion pill, mifepristone, through telemedicine means that the reversal of Roe might be more symbolic than effective. After Texas' abortion ban took effect last September, abortion pill orders tripled, a major reason why Texas abortion rate fell just 10%. During the pandemic, the Food and Drug Administration eliminated its requirement for an in-person doctor's visit to dispense mifepristone, and the Biden administration plans to make the change permanent. Red states are already trying to ban access to abortion medication, so even if Roe falls, the bitter legal and political struggle between pro-choicers and pro-lifers will not go away. That's because red states won't be content to ban abortion within their borders, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. Missouri Republicans, for example, are considering a law allowing state residents to sue doctors for performing an abortion on a Missouri resident in a different state, like neighboring Illinois, whose clinics serve countless Missourians. Red states might even order blue states to extradite doctors who perform abortions on their citizens or enforce civil judgments against them. Is any of that constitutional? The Supreme Court will have to decide. Rather than letting states make their own democratic decisions, overturning Roe will actually create fierce conflict between the states. Emboldened Republicans are even talking about banning IUDs and the birth control pill, which they consider abortive fashions, said Paul Weldman in the Washington Post. Make no mistake, once Roe falls, conservatives aren't just going to declare victory. Trump, is his clout within the GOP fading? Is Trump losing his grip on the Republican Party? Asked Michael D'Antonio in CNN.com. His rallies now draw 1,000 people instead of 15,000. And longtime GOP pollster Frank Luntz recently said many Republicans are sick of Trump's obsession with relitigating the lost 2020 election and are laughing at him. The former president has relied on his endorsements to control the party. But last week, he triggered a big backlash from former allies with two primary endorsements for U.S. Senate races. TV personality Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and author J.D. Vance in Ohio, two political neophytes with questionable conservative credentials. What the hell was he thinking? Asked a Pennsylvania County GOP chairman, Dave Ball. Fox News host Laura Ingraham highlighted Oz's once liberal social stances and called Trump's endorsement a mistake. Other Republicans pointed out that before refashioning himself as an obsequious Trumpist, Vance called Trump reprehensible and an idiot and warned that he would lead Americans to a very dark place. To the base, of course, Trump can never fail. He can only be failed, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. That's why conservative critics such as right-wing radio host Eric Erickson are blaming Trump aides for sabotaging him by manipulating him into bad endorsements. That's plainly nonsense, but it does suggest a path for the party to finally wean itself off Trump. Tell MAGA supporters that Trump was a great president, but they need a younger, fresher candidate more likely to win in 2024. That way, Trump remains a hero, but Republicans can give him a gold watch and send him back to the golf course. That's wishful thinking, said Sarah Longwell in The Bulwark. Most of Trump's 140-plus midterm endorsees are doing just fine. Former NFL running back Herschel Walker, who's been accused of domestic violence and lying about his business credentials and has admitted serious mental health problems, remains a shoe-in for the Georgia Senate nomination for no real reason other than he has been all in on Trump. The Oz and Vance endorsements will be the biggest test yet of his remaining power within the party, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. If both long-shot candidates win, Trump will claim, and perhaps even deserve, much of the credit. But a loss for either could signal his demise as the GOP's kingmaker. And we'll read a few of the short notes here. The world has hit 500 million documented cases of COVID. driven by the highly contagious BA2 variant, the number of known cases has surged since the beginning of the year, hitting 300 million in early January and 400 million a month later. About two-thirds of the global population, more than 5.1 billion people, has received at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine. U.S. border authorities arrested 210,000 migrants attempting to cross the Mexican border last month, the highest monthly figure in two decades. Half of those detained in March were immediately expelled under Title 42, a pandemic provision that the Biden administration is lifting on May 23rd. Viktor Medvedchuk, a Ukrainian oligarch and pro-Kremlin opposition leader with close ties to Vladimir Putin, was captured last week as he tried to flee the country. Ukrainian authorities seized his assets, which included 23 houses, 32 apartments, 30 plots of land, 26 cars, and a 300-foot yacht. The U.S. saw at least 10 mass shootings during Easter weekend, which left 8 dead and raised the year-to-date tally of mass shootings to 144, according to the Gun Violence Archive. The archive defines a mass shooting as one in which four or more people are shot. And we'll finish out the show with a quote from Lily Tomlin, who says, "I always wanted to be somebody, but I see now I should have been more specific." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.